Hello and welcome to the EMJ podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Today, I'm once again joined by Professor George Bakris, Director of the Comprehensive Hypertension Center at the University of Chicago, for the second episode in this two-part series. Last week, we discussed everything from music in medicine to kidney disease progression. I'm very much looking forward to diving deeper into George's work with diabetes and hypertension, as well as his hopes for the future of healthcare. So, George, let's get back into it. I recall that a while ago there was this new modality, renal denervation for resistant hypertension. It promised a great deal back then. Does it still have a role today?
It does have a role to play. At the time that you're talking, I was intimately involved with the development of the original Simplicity HTN-3 study. And at that time, there was a lot of uncertainty. They thought they were doing good denervation. Turns out they weren't. They thought that the catheter was the end-all be-all. It wasn't. So there's two types of denervation. There's ultrasound with the ReCor Paradise device, and there's the traditional Medtronic burning, if you will, denervation, which was the original one that started. Do they work? Well, they both work. The ReCor device tends to have better tolerability, fewer procedural side effects because it uses ultrasound to burn the nerves. The other problem is you've got to get deep into the renal artery because the renal nerves do not actually get exposure to what you're giving them until you're almost in the kidney. So you've got to be really deep. And the original studies were not. They were halfway in the artery. So does it work? Well, we know for sure that it works because the FDA has critically looked at both, has approved both. The ReCor device was almost unanimously approved. The Medtronic device was dicey, and it did win, but slightly. And if you look at tolerability, they both have very good tolerability. But what kind of delta are you getting? You're getting, on average, about 5 to 7 millimeters of mercury reduction. Now, the FDA definition of an antihypertensive is a placebo-subtracted 5 millimeter mercury reduction. So they do meet that criteria. And the other issue is, when are you going to get that? So the more medications you're on, the less likely you are to get a huge drop, but you still will get a drop. So it does have a role in people that absolutely, positively, refuse to take medication, period. They'd rather drop dead. Then, yes, it should be an option because you will get some benefit. In people that are already taking 4 drugs or 3 drugs and don't want to take any more, it should be an option. So the price of this has not been established. I know in Germany it's been going on for a while, and I understand in the UK it's going on. But I have no idea what the price is in the UK. In Germany, if you want the procedure done at least 2 years ago, it was $13,000. So, and I don't know if insurance pays for this or if they defray the cost. And in the US, it's not established yet what they're going to do. So this is a limitation. So it does have a role, but in a subset of people. Now, keep in mind, there are not one, not 2, but 5 different antihypertensives being developed with different mechanisms that won't be out for at least another 3 to 5 years. But these agents are being looked at. Some of them are being looked at in people with advanced kidney disease already taking 3 or 4 drugs. And you're getting very nice reductions in blood pressure of 10, 12 millimeters, which is better than denervation. So the side effect profile is also very tolerable. So I think it remains to be seen where they're going to be there. Some friends of mine have said that, yes, it's around. It's going to be a minority of people. And by the time all these other drugs come out, by 2030, we're not sure there is going to be a role for it. So this all remains to be seen. I mean, you know, it's the hype was definitely not there. People were yelling at me back in 2015 when I said, do not expect big effects here. And they said I was an idiot. And so I said, okay, who's laughing now? So, you know, this is where we are.
Truly fascinating. And I was thinking back in my pharmacology textbook that there was a graph, which was the phases in the life of a drug. And, you know, it's like time along the x-axis and utilization along the y. And, of course, it's, you know, no interest. Suddenly, you know, it cures cancer, baldness, anything, right? And it goes, shoots up. Then, of course, one episode, two patients with aplastic anemia. It's a poison. I wouldn't give it to my dog. And it plummets. And then it, you know, there's some rational clinical trials and it says in the right patient and at the right dose, this can be a very useful therapy and it finds its place. It's right. A pity that we have to go through the highs and the lows to get to the sensible, but thank you for that. So sure. George, you've served on many guideline committees and you chair the American Diabetes Association's Blood Pressure Consensus Panel. You're a member of the American Heart Association panel, updating resistant hypertension guidelines. Can you tell us about the changes that these two groups have recommended? But the second part of my question, you know, I've sat on these sort of committees. There are many, many guidelines. And I sometimes get so darn frustrated because you do a huge amount of work to develop an evidence-based guideline and then no one implements it.
Yeah.
So, two parts. What are you up to? What have you found? And how can we do a better job getting people to deploy them?
So you're absolutely correct in terms of what you said. Let me just say this. Serving on the national guideline committees, and the resistant hypertension committees, everybody looks at the data, everybody comes up, everybody has their role in terms of what area they're going to look at. And then they present it to the group and the group discusses it. And then we critically look at the data and then statements are made and they get refined and all of a sudden it comes out. It is a tremendous amount of work and people will look at it and they don't pay attention. They don't appreciate the work that has gone into deriving it. And then the comment that comes back from the practitioner, well, they're not talking about my patients. These are patients in studies. It's bias. These people are getting money from the companies, blah, blah, blah. Of course, none of that is true, but that's what they believe. So the only group that has actually taken the bull by the horns is the cardiologists in the U.S. that I know of. And what they've done is they have a whole campaign of get with the guidelines. And they're monitoring it and they're very feverish about it. And if you're doing something that's not in the guidelines, let me tell you, you may get indicted. I mean, they're very, very strict about, you know, why you're not doing it and what's your excuse. So that's the only group. The kidney guidelines, on the other hand, which I've also served on, very few people other than nephrologists even pay attention to it. And even nephrologists don't pay attention to it. And then everybody wants to say something a little different. The data is the data. And if you're going to say something different, that means it's your interpretation. If it's your interpretation, well, guess what? I can have an interpretation too. Who are you? So there's the problem, is the desire to be different. Valentin Fuster, who is an internationally known cardiologist, was the editor of JACC, Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And in 2019, Valentin asked me to write a paper on the U.S., comparing U.S. and European guidelines for hypertension. And because I was not a part of the committee in that 2017 guideline, but I was in previous guidelines, he wanted me to do it. And then he wanted somebody that was not part of the European guidelines to be my co-editor, a co-author, and put it together. So we did, and we published it in JACC. And it was a very short article. I mean, it was published, it was 5 pages. But it was full of tables and basically simple statements summarizing things. And I mean, I didn't pay attention to it, but I got an email saying that it was one of the most quoted papers in 2020. So I think people are willing to listen, but they don't want to be inundated with data. And we did this with the JNC7. When we wrote the JNC7, we had the JNC7 short, and then we had the full document. And we published the short in JAMA, and the document was, I think, published 7 pages. And then the full document with all the evidence was published in Hypertension, and that was, I think, 90 pages. So for the scientist, researcher that wants all the hard data, it was there for you. But for the practitioner that just tell me what to do, it was in the short paper. And I think that's what a lot of my colleagues don't get. It's like, if I don't tell you why I'm saying it, you won't believe me.
Yeah.
The bad news, I can tell you why I'm saying it and you still won't believe me. So that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard one guy say at a conference, he says, you can talk all you want about evidence-based medicine, but I've got my experience to guide me.
Exactly.
Head in hands. Yeah.
So that's alive and well.
Yeah. So changing topics quite a bit, actually. Addressing disparities in healthcare delivery, a lot of people focus on that. In fact, I was talking to, I've had two other conversations today about this. But you also have to take into account that disease incidence can differ by race and so on. Can you speak a bit about the current research that you're conducting, looking at why kidney disease is significantly higher in African-American populations?
Well, I will tell you, we did what I consider to be a seminal study funded by the NIH and published. The original paper was published in 2002. It was the African-American Study of Kidney Disease. And this was a paper that had 1,094 African-Americans across the U.S. And it was a 5-year randomized trial looking both at blood pressure level and at antihypertensive medications. The conclusion of that study, which was published in JAMA, was that if you have to be on an ACE inhibitor at maximal doses to get a benefit, and there was no additional benefit at blood pressures below 120. So as long as you're below 130, in a subset, you got a benefit if you really had advanced disease. But really, if you were below 140, you got a benefit, period. So all this stuff that you hear today about aggressive blood pressure reduction below 120 has nothing to do with the kidney. The kidney, in a number of other studies, basically gets its maximal benefit if you're in the 130, 132 range. That's fine. You go below that, and it's a subset of people, not everybody, that's going to get cardiovascular benefit. But even then, it's not below 120. It's like 122. So the African-Americans in that study largely had a history of poor adherence to medication, which is well known, and did not get a full understanding of their disease. One of the things we noticed is nobody really talked to them about the fact that they had kidney disease, how they got kidney disease, and the family implications, the genetic implications of this. So the current approach is African-Americans, yes, they do have, we have the APOL1 gene that we noticed. And if you have that, you're more at risk for developing kidney disease if you're African-American. That does not mean that the patient shouldn't be educated, not only about diet, but about natural history. That does not mean that you should not aggressively treat these people. No, you do not need to be super aggressive and get their pressures to 120. But you definitely need to get them to 130 or a little below that. And yes, they need to be told they're going to need multiple medications. And one of the advantages that you have in Europe that we don't, only because we have it, but the insurance companies won't allow it, is use of combination, single pill combination therapy. Because patients don't care about number of medications. They care about number of pills.
Yes.
Period. So if you know what you're doing, you can treat a person with 4 medications and 2 pills, and maybe even less than that if you know what you're doing with triple combos. And there are now studies coming out with 4 medications as a combo. And so there's no question that we are handicapped by our idiot payers. And I'm not apologizing for that. They are idiot payers because they're only interested in money. But you have a panoply of combinations. And again, my good friend Brian Williams mandated single pill combination as initial therapy in the European guidelines in 2019. So I'm a big believer in that, I always have been. African Americans do not have the knowledge base that a lot of non-African Americans have, because most of them will not go to the internet. They're not going to look up a bunch of stuff. They're going to believe what their neighbor told them, or they're going to believe what some family member told them. So they really need a teacher, and that's what the physician can be. Now, I realize there's limited time and there's limited resources, because it's socioeconomics. And so you need to be sensitive to that and try to facilitate that if you can. Not the physician can't do everything, but he needs a team of people that can help facilitate this, because the patient will work with you if they see you care. If they see you're just being treated like everybody else and you're there for 10 minutes and you're gone, well, no. And then they'll have questions, but they'll be hesitant to ask them because they think you're going to get mad. So you really need to be sensitive to where they're coming from. And by the way, this is not just true in Blacks. This is true in all deprived socioeconomic groups.
Now, access to care can mean many things. So you've already mentioned this, diabetes. The incidence has risen dramatically. There's a lack of awareness that it's not just a bit of sugar in your wee, as they used to say in Liverpool, where I went to med school. It's a serious disease with profound consequences. What of the promise of the new classes of drugs that are these alphabet soup drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors, DPP-4s, GLP-1s, blah, blah, blah? How good are they?
They are phenomenal. They are phenomenal. The SGLT2s will help with your blood sugar if the kidney function is good enough to get them to help. What do I mean? If you have a GFR that's 60 or above, these drugs will do an excellent job of controlling your blood sugar, because they're going to dump the glucose the kidney would normally come back to the body with. So you're going to have a very rich glucose in the urine, but your serum glucose will drop. But more importantly, these drugs will protect the kidney. They will protect the heart against heart failure. And what we know from other trials is if you use SGLT2s in combination with finerenone, you'll get a dramatic reduction in heart failure hospitalization in these patients. So SGLT2s are now mandated by the American Diabetes Association as first-line therapy in anybody that has kidney disease or heart disease. So that's number one. The GLP-1 RAs are also phenomenal. And at higher doses, you will lose weight. At medium doses, your blood sugars will be beautifully controlled. And at those medium doses, you will get a reduction in atherosclerotic cardiovascular events. And now we know that, at least we don't know the data yet, this hasn't been released, but the news release suggests that the FLOW trial, which is over 3,500 people with kidney disease from diabetes, was stopped early due to overwhelming efficacy. So that means that they are helping the kidney as well. So this is, you got those two classes of drugs, and those two classes of drugs are being pushed big time. Now, DPP-4s are kind of interesting, but so what? They were a surrogate for the GLP-1 RAs before they were ever developed. And they're a reasonable drug, but after about 2-3 years, they lose their efficacy. So they're not great for glycemic control going out long term. These other agents are good. And again, we know with the GLP-1 RAs, if you increase the dose, you will lose weight. And that will help everything, not just glucose. That'll help blood pressure. That'll help lipids. That'll help a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I know there's a massive, massive utilization of these drugs. And I know sort of like a black market in them. Fascinating. So, George, you've had a long career thus far, hopefully much more to come. Tell us about the major changes you've witnessed over your career. I'm thinking about, in my professional lifetime, how I've seen heart disease and renal disease change, and what unmet needs in hypertension and renal disease remain to be met? Sort of some bullet point observations.
Well, I'm gonna summarize the answer to that question by telling you what I was told at the FDA when we went with a proposal for a new antihypertensive with a novel mechanism that really had some phenomenal data. And they listened to it, and the head of the cardiorenal group at the FDA turned to me, and you know, we're friends, we've known each other for a while, and he goes, "George, what the hell are you doing here? Yeah, there's over 120 antihypertensive drugs. If you can't treat hypertension with these drugs, then you're either an idiot or the patient's not listening to you. And we all know that the patient's not listening to you. So therefore, what is this going to do?" And so it's recognized even by regulatory authorities that adherence is a major problem. I have not seen that that's improved dramatically. I have seen blood pressure control rates, at least in the U.S., have fallen. They've improved in Canada, but they've fallen in the U.S. And in parts of the world, they've been stable. They have not improved. Now, you'd say with all the available things that we have, things should get better. They're not. In fact, they may be getting worse. So the reality is that what we need to do is change the system to provide better education and better dietary education for patients, and actually change the system. Now, this is, you may not like what I'm going to say here, but I would say change the system so that you can actually monitor the patients and give them some type of economic benefit if they're actually following the rules, because they actually will save you money down the road. And the ones that aren't, basically, I don't know what you do with them, but you need to figure out why they're not following it. And a lot of times they're scared. A lot of times, I mean, there is a minority, they don't want to. But it really boils down to patient adherence. And the even studies, now there was a paper, to get back to utilization of drugs. There was a study that my good friend Roland Schmieder from Germany just published in hypertension. And this was the START study. And what he did is they looked at a database and looked at people that were on combo therapies for everything versus individual therapies for blood pressure. And they followed them out 10 years. And what they showed is, regardless of the combination, all-cause mortality and cardiovascular hospitalizations were dramatically reduced compared to individual pill therapy. Similar pills. So there is a lot to be said about what the patient's willing to do. They're going to listen to you. They're going to be very nice about it. In most cases, they won't challenge you. That does not mean that they have to do what you say. And that's where the rubber meets the road. You need to see the data. And one of the things I do is mandate patients measure their blood pressure and send me the blood pressure, either by electronic medical record or email. What I've realized through the years, and I'm probably going to publish this, is the patients that respond overall do great. And we get good outcomes. The ones that don't respond or never bother calling, the next thing you know, they're in the hospital, or they may have died, or who knows. So you can't help everybody, but for sure you need to go the extra mile to try to get the information to them and try to get some of these people that are on the fence to work with you. And once they see that you're working with them, believe me, they'll respond, because they have a very negative outlook on medical care. Now, I'm giving you, obviously, my interpretation from the U.S. side, and it may be different in Europe. But from what my friends tell me, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, adherence is a huge issue. One of the pharmaceutical company CEOs a number of years ago said, our next $1 billion product is going to be adherence, or compliance, he called it.
Right, so, yeah, right. Well, let me tell you a true story. And this is old. This is going back maybe 12, 13 years. I was at a conference in San Diego, and at the time, the head of endocrinology got up to give a lecture, and he was talking about this patient of his. And she was a very nice lady, African-American, about 70. She had diabetes. He could never get her controlled, never get the hemoglobin A1C below 8. He didn't understand what was going on, and she swore she was doing everything he said. So she invited him to her house. So he went. They had coffee. They talked. And he couldn't understand it. He just did not know what to do. He kept increasing insulin doses. Nothing happened. So as he was leaving, she goes, oh, just a minute. She goes into the bedroom, comes out with one of these 50-gallon bags, garbage bags. And what was in the 50-gallon garbage bag? Insulin, syringes, everything. And she goes to him. She goes, listen, I have no use for this. Why don't you give it to somebody that can help? And then he realized what the problem was. So this is what I'm saying. You know, there's little tricks that I've learned through the years. Are you taking all your medicines? Yes. Are you taking all your medicines every day? Well, no. Well, wait a minute. You just said you're taking, I am taking all my medicines. I take this pill today, that pill tomorrow, that pill the day after. Well, did you ever take them all at once? Oh, no. I'm going to die if I do that. I'm just telling you, this is what's out there.
I know. George, three wishes that you would love to see to improve healthcare as we close out.
Number one, that there was a dramatic improvement in patient trust of the physicians and the system, which is a very tall order, I know. But if you had that, adherence would fall into place, because that is true to a certain extent in Japan. So that's number one. Number two, the current funders of healthcare in the U.S., i.e. the insurance companies, either need to totally revamp their design so that they're not making money and just breaking even, or please go out of business and let us do what we need to do, because the time spent with the patient needs to be increased back to 20 to 30 minutes, not 12. So that's number two. And I think number three really is, regardless of your economic status, you're living on the street or you're a CEO, you get similar healthcare. It won't be exactly the same, but you get the very bare minimum at the very least. And that can be defined in a higher level than what I see now.
George, you're a good man. Those are the sort of reasons why we all went into medicine, was to actually help people. So bless you for that.
Thank you.
Folks, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. I'd really like to thank Professor George Bakris for taking the time to share his insights with us and all that he's done and continues to do for patients. You're a joy to talk to.
Thank you, Jonathan. So are you.
So, folks, please subscribe so you never miss an episode. Check out the archives. Tell your friends and colleagues. Like us on social media. You know the gig. And join us again next week for another fascinating episode of the EMJ podcast. Every week I do this, I learn something new, and it helps me understand the amazing world of medicine even more. And until next time, I'm Dr. Jonathan Sackier. I thank you for listening to the EMJ podcast. Please, everyone, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.